My name's Bill Oakley, and I am an alcoholic. Howdy, everybody. My sobriety date is June of 70, and that's by the grace of God, in rooms just like this with people just like you, that I'm here, and I am grateful for that. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any set, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I've asked Sylvia if she will please to read from the third chapter of the book.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sylvia, and I'm an alcoholic. Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wine, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase this list ad infinitum. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. In a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. This defense must come from a higher power. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Elverna Desjardins, and I'm an alcoholic. This is my home group, the Central Orlando group, and I've been a miracle since March the 10th of 1977. Bill asked me if I wanted to read the traditions, and I said, why, sure. Okay. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, prestige, property divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities. You gonna let Bill sit down now, Bill? Huh?
Yeah.
You can sit down now.
Sorry, Bill. Bill was our greeter tonight, and that's the first time he's had that assignment. Incidentally, while I'm here, please wish Alverna a happy birthday, everybody. Happy birthday, Alverna.
40. I swear I never thought I'd make it. 40.
What do you say, Bill?
Don't go into a depression.
Oh, no.
I was listening to a tape last evening by a very beautiful lady we heard up at the Southeastern Conference in Louisville, Kentucky earlier this fall, Willie B. from Spring, Texas. And she says there's really three A's. We hear two of them, admit and accept. And she says what we best learn to do with admit and accept is to approve. And I got to thinking about that. Yeah, you better approve of your alcoholism. But if you don't, you sometimes have a pretty hard time living with it, you know. But that's the first time I'd heard a speaker offer that particular view of it from a podium. But I've had just another one of those days with which I've been able, I believe, most of the day to walk without causing any harm to anyone, including myself. I didn't find it necessary to take a drink today. And if you're of the type that I am and didn't have to take a drink today, then as far as I'm concerned, you got it made. I don't care much what else went down in life today. If you didn't have to take a drink, why, you got a crack at it as far as I'm concerned. And that was true of me. I, like I walked this day and the God of my understanding let me walk through it without any causing any harm to anyone. There wasn't a lot of turmoil and confusion. And now I'm here amongst friends, feel good, having spent a, well, relatively productive day, and I'm ready to hear a good speaker. And that brings to mind the fact that most often when we get a speaker here, I've heard him before, if he spoke around Orlando at all. But tonight's speaker is going to be different because it was some years ago that he was in Orlando. In fact, this club was really down on Court Street when he visited us some years ago. But I have had the pleasure and opportunity to be in discussion meetings with him and in a one-on-one discussion sitting around the club here. And I've always liked to listen to him, and I've always benefited, if you will, from the things that he's had to say. And I'm quite sure that you will, too, if you'll bear witness to this man this evening. So please help me welcome Aubrey H., please.
I can't get through the side over here. I've already got through. My name's Aubrey Hayes, and I'm an alcoholic. A very, very grateful alcoholic. Very grateful, and I just can't tell you how happy I am to be here tonight. Been around AA for a long time. Happily sober, thank God. And years ago, they asked me to make a talk. First time I ever made one. And I didn't have any idea what. I got stuck for a speaker. Somebody didn't show up, and so they asked me to talk at the last minute. And they said, well, just tell them what you were like, what your life was like, and then tell them how you found AA, and then tell them what your life's been like since. And I've since found out that that's about what all speakers do, and that's about what we're supposed to do. I hope I don't get like that fellow at this meeting one time that fellow was coming into the meeting, and another one was going out, and the one that was coming in says, is he has he finished talking yet? I said, is he through yet? And the fella coming out said, well, he's been through a long time, but he hasn't quit talking. So I hope when I get through, I quit talking and let everybody have some fellowship. So, well, the fellowship in this club is the greatest that I have ever been exposed to in my years in AA. And I go back in AA itself about, I guess, right now about close to 30 years that I've been in. And, not sober all that time, unfortunately, but I've been in a lot of clubs from, Miami to New York City, and, a lot of them in between, and this is, y'all have a club here that, I mean, you can really, really be thankful for. I've never seen the, I don't know the, everybody in it. I'm not gonna dwell on that right now, cause everybody get the big head, but anyway, y'all are gonna find club, and I've certainly enjoyed being here. That's been a lot to me these last few months. I had a wonderful childhood. I can't blame anything on that. I had good parents. My dad was a former professional athlete. He was a pitcher on a baseball scholarship to Alabama, and he was a fine character most of the years that I knew him, and still is. And my mother was a Methodist preacher's daughter, and she was a wonderful person. I had a sister, and she is a wonderful person. She now is a program director with Cerebral Palsy Center in Rome, Georgia. She's worked in that for nearly 20 years now. And, so, I look back on my life and I'm trying to figure out what happened to me, you know, why I took the course that I did. And, apart from alcoholism, what were some of the motivating things? And I'll try to tell you, and maybe you can figure it out, maybe you can identify. I was around AA for a long time before anyone got up and talked, and I could identify with, okay, you could keep coming back, sooner or later somebody's going to come up there that's going to tell your story, or going to tell parts of it. When I came into AA, I was younger than most of the folks in the group, and some of the guys had a different background, and it took me a while, but I finally did, and I've since heard a lot of people that I could identify with to a great degree. But at any rate, I didn't start drinking until I was 17 years old. I was a quarterback on the football team, 3 years a starter, and I was lettered in several sports, and I also was active in other things, dramatics, and I won first in the state in boys solo and baritone solo and things like this. I just seemed like everything I did in my life just turned to gold in my early years. I had, when growing up in my grandfather's home, who was a Methodist preacher, I had thought about being a minister. I wanted to very strongly be a minister when I was young, and then as I got older and these biological urges started flowing through me when I was in my teens and everything like that, it's the most dangerous time in a man's life when you're around 17 years old. But at any rate, I had gone to Camp Glisten in North Georgia, and Carl Hill and I had decided to be ministers. We came back and helped the minister serve communion the following Sunday in the Methodist church there in Forsyth, the next week went over to camp meeting, and there was a boy there, Walter Murphy from Thomaston, Georgia, that played football against us, and we knew Walter pretty well. And we stayed up all day and all night, two nights, talking Walter into being a preacher. And, Walter's the only one who became a preacher. He's a president of LaGrange College now, but he was a Methodist minister before that. Carl's a banker in Forsyth, and I turned out to be an alcoholic. That's sort of a lot of other things I get into, but that was sort of the thing. But I remember we started around 17 years old. We started going out between Forsyth and Barnes and Lynn. There's a fellow out there that sold beer and wine and things like this, and I didn't want to back down when everybody else had a sip of it, and I had a few sips of wine. I didn't particularly like it or dislike it. Shortly after that, we started trying to run around a little bit. Back in those days, people weren't as promiscuous, I guess, for free about things as they are now, and there weren't but one or two girls around there that were at all that way. And I wound up with one of them, and she got caught by her mother, and her mother made her blame everything on me, and it got to be a local scandal. There I was, a grandson of a minister and going to be a minister and all that sort of thing. And I was a little town like that. It just swept from one end of town to the other. And I thought my life was ruined. About that time, my dad decided to move to Savannah to go in business with his brother. This is something they'd planned for years. And we moved down there. And when I got down to Savannah, there were a lot of people who drank socially. They had Pape school parties there. The girls, a lot of the girls in Pape school would later make their debuts, and they served cocktails. See, when you were 16, 17, 18 years old, they were having tea dances and spiking the punch and all that sort of thing. And I started drinking, and I had a fear that I didn't have early in my life, and that was a fear that somebody was going to find out about that little scandal up there in that little town. Didn't amount to anything, but I began to worry about that, and I started drinking a little bit more to forget it. It gave me a lot of insecurity. When I came to Savannah, I went out for the football team. I made quarterback, and they ruled me ineligible about 2 days before the season started because I already had an 11th grade diploma from this other school, and so I went up to Georgia Military College and where I'd been offered a scholarship, and I played ball up there, and I didn't like the military part of it, and so we slipped out at night, and the only place you could go when you got out of there was to go to a beer joint. So we would sit down there around the beer joint, we'd sing and drink beer and this sort of thing, and this is when I guess I first got high. And then when we'd get a liberty to go to Macon or some town near there, why, we would drink beer then. And gradually, over a period of time, I began to enjoy the effects of liquor. I got hurt playing ball. That was a big disappointment to me. I had had this what I thought was a real scandal in my life at that time, and a combination of the disappointment and the other things, I don't know, I just started drinking more and more and more. I transferred back down to Armstrong College in Savannah and fell in with a bunch, and we all began to drink more and more, and I decided that since my career wasn't in athletics, I'd had a pretty serious injury at GMC, and since I wasn't going to be able to play any more ball for a while, that I'd pursue my musical talents. So I had a radio program there in Savannah with WTOC every afternoon at 5 o'clock, and we cut a record. Back then they didn't have tapes, so they weren't so easy to cut. We cut a record and sent it to Arthur Godfrey, and I was supposed to have been on his show. And around that time was when some of my erratic behavior started to come into play. One day the program director who played the organ on the show didn't show up on time to rehearse, and so I quit while we were on the air. So I just walked out. They played the recording of the program that we had before, so we didn't get stuck that day. It happened to be Friday, so they found something else to replace it by the following Monday. They called me a couple of times, but I got real busy pouting about the thing, and I never did go back. And a few months later, ran into a couple of people who were studying in New York, and shortly before Christmas, after an argument with my parents, I decided to catch a train in New York. So I got off New York at Penn Station and just green as a gourd and didn't know where to go. I knew I had this music teacher's name, and I had a couple suitcases and everything. So I looked up a real estate. I knew that all the artists and all the musicians and all the writers lived in some place called Greenwich Village. I'd heard of it. So I got off Penn Station. I got in the cab. I said, "Take me to Greenwich Village." And he looked at me kind of funny, but he took me down there, and I found a real estate guy. The estate man said, "Well, where would you like to live?" I said, "Well, where do all the young artists and writers and singers and actors and people like that live?" I said, "I like to live in that neighborhood." He said, "Well, you pick just about anywhere down here." So I checked in there, and I got a little walk-up with an Italian landlady, and paid the rent, and immediately started to go around the neighborhood and introduce myself to everybody. "I'm Aubrey Hayes from Savannah, Georgia. I'd like to meet you. Going to be in town." Everybody looked at me like I was nuts. But I did meet one guy who was there who had bought a bar, a village bar, and he was from Texas, and his wife was studying opera, and he was miserable there in New York City, but he and I made friends because we were both from, well, he said, I was from pretty close to where he was from, not too far, so he and I got to be good friends, and then I made a an effort to get into show business. I didn't make a real hard effort because I really, what I enjoyed was the life around show business. You know, I enjoyed all the partying and all the drinking. And I went up and auditioned for a music teacher, and her husband was a stockbroker, and he got me a job running messages down on Wall Street, and enough to get groceries. And at night, I'd make the little piano bars and all around Greenwich Village. And I lined up 5 or 6 of them that would give me all I could drink and tips for coming in and just helping all the customers start singing. And this went on for nearly 2 years, and I didn't miss a day or a night. Well, the days, I slept most of the day, but I mean, when I got up late in the day, that I would go out, and I would begin to drink. And I would come in 3 or 4 in the morning, pretty well soused, and I didn't realize until right toward the tail end of that 2 years, I started blacking out. And I would wake up without any idea about where I'd been or anything else. It began to scare me. Seriously. And I thought that I was losing my mind and began to get much more secretive about my drinking. I mean, whereas before I hadn't minded what anybody thought about it or how much I drank or anything like that, I began to have a couple of drinks or something like that, and I'd say, well, I think I'll go home now. I got an audition tomorrow or something like that, and I would leave. I'd hit another place and drink two or three. I said, well, I got to go now. And every place I was constantly leaving, you know, after a couple of drinks. I never let anybody know how much I drank or anything like that, but I was drinking constantly. And finally, I had a real Pier 6 brawl with three guys in a bar one night, and I don't remember what started it or anything else, but it pretty well finished me. And I wound up with a black eye and a busted lip, and the irony of the whole thing is I just got in a part in a play. But anyway, I had to go home. I was broke. I was sick. And when I got home and got off the train late one night, my mother and dad, my dad picked me up and brought me home. My mother took one look at me and screamed. And I hadn't had a haircut. I'd gained probably 20, 30 pounds. I didn't realize what that life of dissipation would do to you, you know, that much of it. I hadn't exercised, taken training, anything like that in that long a time. But at any rate, this started a period of periodic drinking because I was under their surveillance pretty much, and I would get jobs, good jobs, through them or other family connections or something like this, and I would work at them, stay sober for 2 or 3 months, and then all of a sudden, just go off on a bender. And this was when they began to be pressured to join AA. At that time, I was around 25 years old. And I went to AA mainly to get them off my back. I'm leaving out a lot of things like wrecks and DTs, which I had in a hotel in Richmond, Virginia, trying to quit drinking after I'd had caused a three-car collision. Had a good job with Southern Cotton Oil Company, Snowdrift and Western Oil. I'd gone up there to work, and George is nodding his head. He knows. And I'd gotten it through a friend of my dad's and got up there and started drinking and partying and ran into a couple of cars that had stopped. Nobody, fortunately, was hurt, but I swore off drinking right after that. And at one night, I 5 or 6 days after I'd quit drinking, I saw, as I would turn off the light in the hotel room, an old Richmond hotel there in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, I'd see someone come through my joining door and stand at the foot of my bed. And I'd turn the light on and they'd be gone. And I would turn it off and try to go to sleep again, and I would see them more plainly this time. And finally I could make out the features. And I thought, with my religious upbringing, I thought the devil was after me. And I kept the light on, left it on, dug around frantically, and finally found a Gideon Bible that I'd stuck around in one of the bottom drawers, and I read that Bible all night. And I kept this to myself, and I guess this is when some of my paranoia started. Because I felt like, boy, on the heels of everything that's happened and all the other things that I've done, if my mother and dad or any of these people hear about this, they're going to lock me up and they're going to throw away the key. So my drinking got more and more secretive. Finally, one day I got pressured into going to AA, and I went up to the old AA club room at Liberty Street in Savannah, and there were 4 or 5 guys sitting around there talking, and they shook hands with me, welcomed me, asked me to want some coffee, and they kept on with their conversation, and I was listening to them talk about some of the jails they'd been in, and some of the benders they'd been on, and how they drank a fifth or two a day, and all that sort of thing. Boy, I said, good God, I can't imagine people sitting around telling things like this about themselves. This is a heck of a spot for some blackmailer to get into, you know? And I began to listen and listen, and finally one fellow got up and he talked about getting on a drunk, winding up in Charleston, and he woke up and there were 4 cannibals sitting on one in each bedpost, and one of them was trying to bite his foot, and I said, what do you suppose was the matter? He said, oh, I had the whim-whims. He said, I had them a lot of times. He said, no problem. He said, no, hadn't. He said, you get them when you cut off drinking. And I realized, my God, I'm not crazy. Thank God. You know, that's what I had. And eventually, I started to tell some of this, get some of this off my chest, and some of this, 8 or 10 or 15, it seemed like 8 or 10 years, I guess, and not that long, really, it was maybe at that time, 7 years, I guess, of pretty much drinking alone, began to get some of this out of me. But what I couldn't figure out was that all these guys in AA were older men. I was young. And after I got sober, I got back in shape, and I felt pretty good. You know, I didn't have any problems much with eating or sleeping or any health problems or anything like this. And I thought after staying sober 3 or 4 months and getting my finances in order and getting a few vitamins back in my system and one thing or the other, that there was no earthly reason why I shouldn't be able to drink. Made sense to me, and that's about all I was concerned with. And so I went out and tried it and got drunk, and then somebody would tell me, sort of like what Sylvia read in the third chapter, all the different things. I'm not going to bore everybody with that, but I tried everything that I could in order to drink. I guess one of the things I tried that probably cost me the most effort and time was after trying all the tall glasses and eating white rice and drinking olive oil and all these other things to try to drink. One day I had sort of skipped over the first step and second step and sort of started about the third or fourth and wound up jumping over 5 or 6 others and was down the 12th step, and I was working with 2 guys in a club there, and I read an article in the Atlanta paper down at the bottom of one of the columns that said, if you have hangovers, eat a little sugar, you know, while you drink, after you drink. And I had these guys a couple of dollars, and I said, well, I'll see y'all. Maybe, I don't think I might not make that meeting tonight, you know, but you guys, AA is a good place for you. And 5 minutes later, I had about 5 sugar cubes in my mouth, and 10 minutes later, I was sitting in a sapphire room with a martini in front of me. And, I came back after that, and it just was a constant. Drinking had become so necessary to me to live, to survive. I didn't like reality. I didn't like any part of reality. I didn't like anything at all about it. And I would look back nostalgically on those days when I was up in Greenwich Village and with all the different people that I knew, and I had at times met some people that were fairly, you know, with national figures or, you know, and so forth. I mean, I didn't know well or anything like that, but, you know, I'd see their pictures and I'd start looking back and nostalgically at all those different times. And around about that time, I'd had a pretty good job on the road and had made good money for back in that particular time, and around nearly $20,000 that year. And I quit the job. I'd rationalized around again and said, well, you know, when I was in the Army, I was a physical instructor and was in good shape, and I could go out and drink all night and give calisthenics all day, and I never suffered from hangovers. So I figured that my problem was that I was just really hadn't gotten really back in real good shape like I had when I got out of physical training school. So I quit that job, and I made that money at the year before and took a job for $50 a week teaching swimming over here at the Daytona Beach YMCA, and I set myself a 3-month schedule to get back in shape. I'd lifted weights in between the swimming classes, and I ate steak and eggs, and I took vitamin shots, and I went to AA. Went to AA just to be sure that I made that 3 months. And at the end of that 3-month period of time, I was in better shape than I'd ever been in. I could do a military press with about 240 pounds 3 times and could run for 3 or 4 miles without getting real winded or anything like that. And I was just in real great shape. I don't think I'd been that great shape when I was in the service. So I had a place picked out on Daytona Beach. I was going to go and drink like a gentleman. And I went over there and ordered a martini and asked for a menu. At 10:30 that night, I still hadn't ordered anything to eat, but I'd had a bunch of martinis. And 3 days later, it took 2 guys to pick me up off the bed and put me on a stretcher and take me over to the hospital. I'm not telling you to brag or trying to tell you a blow-by-blow description of a lot of stuff that is not all that interesting. I just want to tell you how hard I tried to drink. I really did try hard. And every time that I drank, it got successively worse. And I almost, well, I guess I had about that time really given up. I'd as far as my life was concerned, I thought it was about through. I thought that I would never be able to do anything with the drinking and probably accomplish anything else in life. So I'd pretty well, I had pretty well gotten depressed about it. And then I figured, well, maybe getting married might help, you know. Everybody else, man, I'm out here chasing gals all the time, and maybe I should get married. And I did. And after we were married for a while, I went over to St. Petersburg and was down there working for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and I wasn't working too much because I started drinking, sipping beer along, and I got a DUI. It was about I can't remember if it was the third or fourth one. I think it was the fourth one I had within about 5 years. I had several in Georgia, and they were all on my record, and I think two in Florida. And I was out of jail on bond. I was, I thought I lost my job. I was broke. I had maybe $7 or $8 in my pocket. And my wife was divorcing me and taking my little girl. And I called AA. I'd always been able to call AA, and they would always come when I got in a bad situation like that. But this particular time, I called them, and they didn't come. And I remember a lot of the things that I'd heard in the AA talks and so forth about, I knew that I was at a crossroads. I knew that my high bottom drinking days were over, that if I took that $9 or $10 and went across and got a fifth, that it was going to be the asylums and the chain gangs and the jails and things like this. And I'd seen enough jails and chain gangs too that I didn't want to see any more of them, and I didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden it just overwhelmed me just what a mess my life had become and what a mess I was and how hopeless everything was. And I pitched forward on my face out of the chair and just fell on my face on the floor. And I remember praying, and I remember almost exactly how I prayed. I said, Lord, if you'll give me back the peace that I had when I was a boy, I'll do anything you want me to. If you'll get me out of this hell that I've been in. And I said, but if you want me to quit drinking, you're going to have to take away the desire, because I can't quit. At that time, I had been in 50 hospitals. I've been in AA, I've been in Avon Park, I've been in Briarcliff, the Georgia Alcoholic Commission, I've been in Silver Hill 3 months. And some of the hospitals were not really, you know, that long term. They were not 30 days. They were 3 or 4 day drying out spots. But Count Miller's in Jacksonville about 7 or 8 times, and White Cross in St. Petersburg, and Fiddler's up in South Carolina, and the different ones that I went in just to dry out, it was about 50 times that I required some type of treatment. But I don't know what came over me as I was laying on that floor, but I drug myself back to the bed and I said, I'm going to stay here on my knees till I get some kind of relief. And I don't know what it was that came over me. It was like a cold wave of water or something. And I began to cry. And I don't even know how long I stayed there, but when I got up off my knees, I felt like everything was going to be all right. The desire, the shakes, and all that sort of thing had sort of settled down. I dragged myself up on the bed and slept, and the next morning I woke up, and for the first time that I hadn't required some type of medication or something like that, some type of doctor's care. But I looked at my hands and they were steady. Almost. I still had a few anxious thoughts, but overall I felt like everything was going to be all right. I didn't know how. And about that time a knock came on the door, and there was a fellow outside there. And he said, you know, I sure am sorry. He said, we lost your message last night. He said, I'm from the AA. He said, is there anything we can do for you? And I said, well, my car is in the pound. I said, my check's down in Sarasota, and I'm in St. Petersburg. And I said, if you could help me get down there and get that check, I'd appreciate it. Take me by the pound to get my car. So he took me down. The check was only a small one because I hadn't done any work for a while. Cashed it. Went over and got my car out of the pound. And the next day, I'm sharing this with you because I don't know if there's anybody here that doubts the power of a higher power, I want to share this with them. The next day, I went back down over the Sunshine Skyway. I hadn't made $200 in 2 months, mainly because I hadn't worked, but I couldn't sell that stuff either. I really couldn't. That's one of the few things I never did, just didn't like to sell for some reason or other. And I went back the next morning, and I over the Sunshine Skyway, and I sold the first place I called on, the second place, the third place, and then I got lost. I wound up way out in the country in front of a dairy, Hood's Dairy. And I had a card in there for a renewal of Nation's Business magazine they had. We had to pick up a check in advance for 3 years of it. And I said, well, as long as I'm out here, I may as well call him. I walked in, and he was having some problems with his employees. He had 84. And he said, I think I'll send that magazine to all 84 people. Well, instead of renewing the one, I made $7.50 every time I renewed that thing. I made nearly $600-something. I don't remember what that check was, but it was a big one. Plus the others, I came back and made a couple more sales. As I drove back into St. Petersburg, one day, well, maybe 36 hours after being off that stuff, after praying that prayer, I'd made more money than I'd made in 3 or 4 months. And I had told the Lord if I'd do anything he wanted to. And I was kind of standing in an attitude of prayer because I was looking for signs. I thought maybe I'd hear a voice or, you know, see something or hear something, or somebody would come up and say, well, the Lord told me to tell you something or something like that. And I didn't know what, but I was staying in a cooperative kind of a mood because I didn't know what he was, but I knew something was happening. My problem with the checks was that I had to wait till Friday to send them in, and then I didn't get money back till the next Friday. So I didn't give me an immediate money, and I was about broke. And I got to thinking, well, where could I go to get any money? And I didn't know where to go. Well, that next morning I had a place to call on in St. Petersburg, one last call, and I called on them and renewed them. And next door to it was Mars Brothers Department Store. And I remembered years before that I had an account there. And it had been paid up and everything. I went inside. I said, do you still have my account open here? And they said, well, it's been inactive, Mr. Hayes, but if you need something right now, we just put a $150 limit on it until we can run a check on you. And so I went out and got a suit and a couple of shirts. My clothes were frayed. My shoes had holes in them. And picked up some of those and picked up a tennis racket and some sneakers and some balls because I wanted to try to get back in shape again. And so the thought of this bank that had been cashing my check, my U.S. Chamber check that was a member there in town, flashed through my mind. And so I went over there and I talked to the officer, and I said, I don't have a bank account with you or anything. Didn't have a bank account in the world. But I said, I need to borrow some money until I can get back my commission on these checks I've got to mail in. He said, well, do you have any credit references, any charge accounts? I said, well, Mars Brothers Department Store. He said, well, give me about 20 minutes. So I came back in 20 minutes, and he let me have, I think it was $300. And so I had a little lawyer there in town that had said he could save my license if I could get him $250. So I called him up and went over there. And first thing he asked me was, did you get the money? Well, I didn't lie to him. I said, I've got 100 of it. I didn't tell him I had the whole amount. I gave him 100, came back and paid my landlady, and then I sent the balance of it, except for $8 or $10, to my wife and daughter in Georgia. I hadn't sent them any money in months. And didn't know what I was going to do. Well, because I had no real permanent address, they were sending my assignments to the post office in St. Petersburg. And they'd come in a big brown envelope, and I wouldn't know until they got there where I was going to have to work next. And so I went down there, General Delivery, and picked it up. And when I opened it up, it was Orange County, Florida. And my mother and dad happened to be living in Winter Park. And that's that time you were talking about when I started going down to Court Street down here. I knew something was really happening in my life, but I still had hanging over me that DUI. And the lawyer had gotten it postponed for several months. Finally, he called me up over here. He says, Aubrey, you got to come back over here. He said, the prosecuting attorney is ready to call that thing up for trial, and I can't postpone it anymore. I wasn't drunk when they picked me up, so I was pleading not guilty. And when I came in, I found out that my attorney and the city attorney over there were political enemies. So my attorney is a real sharp guy. He was also had been appointed as a state's attorney. He started cross-examining the witnesses, and he discredited one policeman's testimony altogether. He got to the next one they were going to bring up for the prosecution, and my attorney challenged the witness because he was not on the list of witnesses that were given him before the trial. And the city attorney was a little bit hot-tempered. He jumped up and he said, well, Your Honor, he said he was not on the list of witnesses, but said you heard me tell him in chambers before the meeting that he was one of the witnesses that I was going to call. And my attorney just smiled and he looked up there at the judge. He said, Your Honor, I move for a mistrial on the grounds that this man's offered testimony without being properly sworn in as a witness. And the judge said, mistrial granted. So they called me and they said they're going to bring it up again in several months, maybe. And I asked my attorney if he could get it settled, and he went up and got it settled for careless and reckless, and I paid the fine and left. Well, anyway, that's a long story, but it might seem like coincidences to people, but those kind of coincidences had not happened to me before. They simply had not ever happened, and not in years had I ever had that many good breaks. And I continued to trust the higher power. The first time I really turned my will and life over to him was in that motel room over there, and I continued to go to AA, continued to work in that. I also went back to church and things like this, because I feel like that anything, and I felt like then and I feel like now, anything I can fill my mind with, you know, that's good, to replace some of the thoughts that I had played around with for years. I mean, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. But anyway, walking with him a lot of times, trying to walk this AA way of life, you can't always see progress. You take a couple of steps forward, and one day, and maybe three backwards the next, and then two forward the next, and two backwards the next, and then maybe five forward. And if you look at it from day to day, sometime you can get really discouraged. It's only when you look back over a period of time that you can really see the progress. And this is what I'm so grateful for tonight. I don't like to try to prepare too much for what I'm going to say when I get up to talk. And yet I don't like to ramble, you know, either. But one of the things that I'd like to say, and I feel like that I'd be awfully ungrateful if I didn't, would be that there's not one thing in these years since that time in St. Petersburg, and that was August the 8th, 1963, that happened to me. Not one time have I ever had a desire for a drink since that time. I don't give myself credit for staying sober. I give AA and the higher power credit for staying sober. I just simply haven't had the desire. I've had a lot of things happen to me. I've had businesses go broke. I've had divorce. I've had various and sundry things, but the thought of drinking hasn't come up. Every time I've had some adverse thing happen to me, it looked awful. I remember after being sober about like a year and a half in Jacksonville, I was going to the San Marco Club a lot, and I had left the U.S. Chamber and gotten a job selling Yellow Pages, and I was third from the top on the Jacksonville Book, which is the biggest book in North Florida, selling Yellow Pages. And I liked it because they had a lot of fringe benefits with Southern Bell and that sort of thing. And when the Jacksonville Book was finished, I had worked hard. I was down there every night working later than anybody else, because I really appreciated the job. They called me down to Jacobsville and fired me. And I couldn't figure it out. It was the first time that I'd ever honestly, legitimately ever stayed sober over a year. And I said, well, what was the matter? And they said, well, we run a security check on everyone, and we picked up a pattern of drinking from your past life. And if we let you get by with it, then we'll never be able to deal with the union or anybody else if they ever have anybody with a drinking problem. Said, so it's just something that we hate. And the manager for the directory there told me, he's the vice president of the company, he said, I'll tell you this, Arbor. He said, I'll recommend you for a job with anybody. He said, of all the fellows we've had go through here, if I could pick just one or two guys, he said, you'd be one of them. He said, I appreciate it, but there's nothing I can do. And that really shook me. Boy, my little girl had circled on the calendar May the 8th. That was when we were supposed to get a place and get them back together. They'd been living with my father-in-law. And all that time. And I didn't know what to do. And I went back down to the AA club and had a cup of coffee and talked to a couple of fellows down there that had meant a lot to me over a period of time. Pappy N and Harry G. I know y'all know those people. And until I got over the initial shock of it, and I got in my car and I drove up to Georgia. And when I got up there, everybody in the family was on the front porch coming to see me. Drive in. Cousins, uncles, aunts, everybody. Couldn't believe that I'd made it up there sober after that kind of a disappointment. My brother-in-law had gotten on the phone and called them and told them what had happened. They were all torn up about it, and I was too. So about a week later, I went back down to Jacksonville, still disappointed. Problems to put up with, not less politics than they had in the Yellow Pages. That's what I'm talking about. Every time that I ever lost anything since I started walking with a higher power, and I thought I lost something. I always got something back so much better. I heard a story the other night on this Christian broadcasting company up here, that broadcasts out of Apopka somewhere, and the fellow was telling a story about a little girl. He said she liked to play dress up, and said she had this favorite thing that she liked to dress up with, and it was a necklace, a little metal necklace, and said it had gotten so old and worn that it discolored her neck. And said she just played with it, and her mother and father worried about it, and one day her daddy, the day before her birthday, her daddy took the necklace away, and the little girl cried. She was just inconsolable about that necklace. She just heartbroken. And the next day when the birthday came, the first present that they gave her to open, she opened it up and there was a string of simulated pearls. And the fellow went on to say that the father had known about the other gift when he took the other one away. So many times we have to trust. We have to have faith. We don't really know what goes, you know, around the bend. We don't know what's going to be. But I know this. I feel like it's going to be better for us. I really feel like whatever it is, as long as we leave it to the higher power, as long as we turn it over to Him. And, you know, I believe that so strongly today. I see people sitting here that I know have been completely transformed through the grace of the higher power, working through this program. You know, the higher power, as I understand him, manifested himself in Jesus. And when I look back and I research it, I see him as the most skillful molder of human souls that ever lived. Ever lived. Because he never saw people for what they were. He always saw them for what they might become. Stop and think about it. And if there's one thing that we can do, and I think most of you do it already, because I've noticed a lot of people come through these doors off of a drunk, been sleeping in the weeds, sweat popping out of every pore in their body, shaking. And I've watched people go up to that door and welcome them. Because after you had the transformation that can come through this program, you don't see people like that. You see people as they might become. This program, the 12 Steps, I was thinking a little last night about some of the things that I just wish I could find the words to say. And I never did find the right words, but I'm going to try. if you look at those steps, and if you're talking to somebody who's just coming into the program, it says in chapter 5, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And I think if the truth's known, I think probably they could say never have we seen anybody fail who's thoroughly followed. I never have, who's thoroughly followed our path. And what was the path? Well, it starts right up there. They admitted, and they came to believe, and they made a decision. They made a moral inventory. They admitted to themselves, to God, and another human being. They were ready to have these shortcomings removed. And when you're talking to anybody that's coming into AA, I think without qualification, you can tell them, if they follow that path, guess what they're going to get? They're going to get a spiritual awakening. They're going to have a message that they can carry. And what's even more important, I think, well, not more important, but just equally as important, is this. It's certainly important to friends and relatives and loved ones and things like this, that they're going to be able to practice these principles in all their affairs. Boy, what a transformation. I don't know any church, any organization. And I'm not knocking them, because they do a lot of good. A lot of good. But I don't know any of them that if they had this sort of a situation to go on, I don't know. I just wonder sometime if there'd be any unfortunate people anywhere in the world if you had all those numbers of those people behind them. But with this program working like it is and like it does, and with the fact that you can guarantee anybody that if they follow that path, they're going to have a spiritual awakening. They're going to have a message to tell. And they're going to be able to practice those principles in all their affairs. Whew. Boy, that's some kind of a guarantee. If they got where I did. If they came from where I did. James W. Foley wrote a thing called A Tale of the Trail. He said, "It ain't so far from right to wrong. The trail ain't hard to lose. Sometimes I'd almost give my horse to know which one to choose. Wrong sometimes looks like the driven snow, and right looks awfully black." And there ain't no signboards on the track. I don't set up to be no judge of right and wrong in men. I've lost the trail sometimes myself, and I may get lost again. But when I see someone who looks as though they've gone astray, I want to shove my hand in theirs and help them find a way. And I know you all do too. Thank you.
And I certainly thank you. Yes. I couldn't help but reflect, you know, when I crawled out of a jail to come to these rooms the first time, the men who met me and said, welcome, you know. They didn't say where you came from or any of these things. They just said, we're glad you're here, you know. And didn't bring up my past or all the hideous things I'd done. Just, what do you want to do now about your life? If we can help you do it, we want to do it. I thought, boy, that's fantastic. And the transformation. God, how we get to witness it. I think that's one of the most fantastic things about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never tire of thinking about it or saying it, to tell you the truth. You and I are the only people on God's green earth that any time we want to live the golden moment, that we experience that thing he did in that hotel room, all we got to do is to walk into a program of Alcoholics Anonymous and see that new person there and see the confusion and the turmoil and the self-contempt he has and the loathe he has for himself and everything. And know full well that if you'll come into this program and follow those 12 steps, that he can experience that transformation too. So anytime you want to live that golden moment, all you got to do is come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's made available to you. Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, I felt many times it's a long ways from that jail a little over 15 years ago to this podium tonight. But you know, one drink and it's straight to jail. Do not pass go and do not collect $200, because that's where I'd go. Certainly want to thank you, Aubrey. Certainly do.